Hi, and welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network on the internet, broadcasting from two shipping containers outside Roberta's Pizza at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Creek.
And we are the Garden Ladies of Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens in New York City and the surrounding area, and this show aims to bring the culture to horticulture.
We aim for that.
We aim for that.
But we have a great rock star gardener today.
That's right. We swam across the ocean.
Across
the pond to England. We're speaking with Noel Kingsbury. Noel, are you on?
Hi, Mom. Yep, hi.
Hi, great. Noel. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good, good. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thanks for asking me.
Well, I'm going to tell our audience a little bit about you. You have quite a lot of gardening experience. Noel Kingsbury, for those of you who have never heard of him, is an internationally known writer and gardener and garden designer. He writes about plants and gardens and the environment. He's also a teacher and a lecturer and, planting designer and horticultural consultant. He's best known for his promotion of what is broadly called an ecological or naturalistic approach to planting design. Noel has written some 15 books on various aspects of plants and gardens, two of them in collaboration with another horticultural rock star, Dutch designer and plantsman Pete Udolf. He writes regularly for Gardens Illustrated, The Daily Telegraph, The Guardian, The Garden, Hortus, and a number of other publications. Noel has been actively involved in the promotion of quality public planting for many years. He undertakes consultancy work in the fields of garden maintenance and development, roof greening, facade greening, and collaborations with artists working in the public sphere. He writes a quarterly opinion column for Green Places, the Public Space Journal. And that's the abbreviated version. Right, Noel?
Right, yeah, there's more.
Much, much more. Well, I also wanted to congratulate you because I heard that you recently got married.
Oh, that's right. Yes, yeah. Joe and I have been together for 20 years, and we find it was actually our solicitor, our legal advisor, who said to us, you guys ought to get married for all sorts of tax reasons.
For tax purposes.
Anyway, it was a nice thing to do. We had a fun weekend with the family.
Good.
That's great.
In a garden, I hope.
No, you don't want to do anything outside on a garden here at this time of year.
That's true. It could rain.
It could rain. We've actually had an incredibly cold December.
Oh, okay.
More like one of your winters, actually.
I had read about that, Noel. It's not very typical for this past few decades.
Very, very, very untypical. I mean, trying to translate it to Fahrenheit, we went down to about 10 Fahrenheit.
Wow.
It's unbelievably cold for us.
Right.
So why don't you tell our audience a little bit about how you ended up working in horticulture? I had read that there's a legend that you skipped out of school to attend the Chelsea Flower Show, and I have...
Yeah, that's right. I mean, my father was a very keen gardener. My mother knew all the names of the wildflowers. And had a couple of friends at school who were also very keen gardeners, interested in growing kind of unusual stuff. And, we're not that far from... Well, I was brought up not that far from London. Tuesday afternoon was just sport, just a waste of time as far as we're concerned. So more than 1 year, actually, we skipped off to go to the Chelsea Flower Show.
And what was that like for you?
Well, it was... And in those days, the Chelsea Flower Show was dominated by these huge nursery stands.
Ah.
It was really before the garden. The gardens, they were pretty much playing second fiddle. Very exciting experience, just to see so many really unusual plants, really well grown, really imaginatively put together. Just made me very aware of the incredible breadth and skill of the British nursery industry.
Yes, yeah. It's very remarkable, and you're lucky that you get to go. Carmen and I always want to go every year, but it's right in the middle of our big, busy planting time.
Yeah, to be honest, the Chelsea Flower Show is not what it used to be.
No.
And there's a lot more smaller flower shows now, which I quite honestly, a lot of people find a lot more interesting to go to. Chelsea has become much more about gardens, rather over-designed gardens.
Mm-hmm.
Fewer of the nursery people go.
It's more like an installation, right?
It's become a bit of an installation, yeah.
That's what was happening here in the States, too, and many, many shows have closed. I mean, there used to be a New York Flower Show, a San Francisco show. Philadelphia is still going on, but it really consists of mostly tents with people selling, you know, plumeria cuttings, and, you know, there's very little horticulture left.
Yeah, no, it's a difficult recipe to get right. Well, there's a lot to do with, you know, getting the time of year right, having the right place. No, I mean, every country has its own different model of flower show. I mean, I'm not entirely convinced that ours works particularly well either, actually.
I understand what you're saying. We were excited to learn that you actually got the opportunity to meet Roberto Burle Marx, one of the giants of landscape architecture. Right. What did you learn from that experience?
Well, Roberto at the time was, he was more or less on his deathbed. I mean, he was terminally ill. So unfortunately, I wasn't able to spend too much time with him. But I was able to stay in his house, which is this rather beautiful place outside Rio with a fantastic plant collection.
Sublime.
And through various bits of negotiation, was able to get entry into quite a lot of his private gardens, which were really stupendous places. It was also my first time ever to the tropics, my first time ever to Latin America, so there was lots of things happening at once. But it's an experience that stayed very much with me, and I think he really was one of the absolutely exceptional people of the 20th century in bringing together the art of garden and landscape design, but with this passion about Brazilian native flora and actually using a whole lot of new plants for horticulture, both public and private.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about what's happening in Germany and the influence that Germany has had on you.
Yeah, specifically with Pete Udolf.
What really struck me, this was back in 1994 when I first went to Germany and also started to go into Holland and meeting Pete Udolf. And what's interesting about Germany is that whereas in Britain, all the interesting stuff that happens in gardening happens really within the private garden and private sector. In Germany, it's all about public parks and public spaces. And there are these fantastic parks planted up with all the familiar garden perennials, but used in such a completely different way, a much freer, much more expansive, a much more naturalistic way. And so it was that coming together of the familiar and the unfamiliar that just completely blew me away. And then meeting Pete, the Dutch tradition is much more close, really, to the British one. I mean, in a way, his work was more conventional, but he was using a lot of plants, you know, grasses in particular, which we were not familiar with being used, and a lot of big late-flowering perennials. And so his work was quite kind of architectural, quite structural, but with a lot of very exciting, new, and also quite low-maintenance plants.
Right, right. I really wish that America would adopt that. I mean, I think our big kind of pet project right now is the Highline.
Yes.
Which is which is
fabulous. It could
fabulous.
Be a fantastic inspiration, that. Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, that
and
does...
And other places like the Lurie Garden in Chicago.
Right.
I mean, a lot of good things happening in the States in gardening, but they're all in little sort of pockets.
Exactly.
And then there's kind of vast swathes where nothing happens but lawn.
Exactly, and that's what I was just going to say. There's the, you know, vast suburban kind of empty, you know, hedges up against a suburban house, and it's horrible, you know, especially...
I don't know if the name Tova Martin means anything to
Tova
you.
Tova Martin, yeah.
Sure, yes.
Right. Yeah. But Tova and I we're just about to start blogging together for Gardening Gone Wild.
Oh,
blog.
Fantastic!
And so we've gotten into correspondence, and just this morning she sent me, I hope she doesn't mind me reading this out, but a paragraph, I think, do you realize that the US is still fighting back the frontier? Anything but lawn gives most folks the jitters. Most people are still in the cowboy and Indian mode and need wide open spaces to watch for the enemy. I figure that's how this began. We are irreverent, bratty, spoiled iconoclasts, but just don't ask us to shake up the foundation plantings.
Oh.
And I'm glad it's, I mean, if I said that, I would just come across as a kind of loudmouth, arrogant old European. But there's an American saying it, so
that's
I don't have to
great.
Say anything else.
it's pretty astounding coming from Tova, you know, because her physicality is a sweet, you know, like appearance,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
You don't expect that language, like that strong
that
language.
Well,
but it's very, very true, and it's a really good way of describing people's reactions. We make a lot of urban gardens, Noel, and
yes.
people, we have to talk, even urbanites that have every square inch matters, you know, and they
yes,
want
yes.
lawn. They want lawn, mm. you know, which is maddening
yeah.
to us, you know. In the
yeah,
shade.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think the reaction against it has started, and James Van Sweden and Wolfgang Irma
mm-hmm.
have done, you know, fantastic work. And you know, when they first did that garden at the Federal Reserve Bank in D.C.,
mm-hmm.
you know, they sort of more or less faced a lynch mob, as far as I gather, and they talked them all around. And that became a really iconic garden. And, you know, the High Line, I think, is a fantastic example of something that's, the High Line is actually far and away the wildest looking thing that Pete has ever done.
Right.
And I think that's a particularly good in inspiration.
It is. In fact, well, you know, Pete's, yours and Pete's book, The Designing with Plants,
yeah.
I think, you know, we work with a lot of younger people that we sort of mentor, and it's become like
yeah.
the Bible for landscape designers, you know,
yeah.
in the 21st century.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I wanted to sort of reach out to those folks that are listening. What was the message that you were trying to convey to readers with that book, with Pete?
Well, I think the plants can be thought of as a language that, you know, what Pete is very good at is looking at plants and saying, well, actually, this, you know, this is what I see. And he uses words like buttons and drumsticks and quite kind of physical language to describe shape rather than colour. So looking at plants as a sort of design language and how you can then put those words, if you like, together with a sort of grammar of design to create to create something.
Yeah, you really have to think of the landscape as a composition as you're
yeah,
designing
yeah.
it. And it's not just a gallery of plants, or it shouldn't be. I think they should all relate and then complement
yeah.
and
yeah.
accentuate each other, you know, and that's what your work and Pete's work does so brilliantly.
So has it taken root now, no pun intended, in England? Are people starting to get rid of their beautiful English lawns and replace some of them with these more meadowy, naturalistic kind of plantings?
It's quite slow. I mean, what has taken off hugely are grasses.
Yes.
Because they fill that awful November gap.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So the grass, we've got the grasses, and there's certainly a much wider range of perennials being grown. I still don't get to see many really good radical new gardens. More and more, but not... It is sort of slow to get through. Everything always gets so watered down. You know, grasses, there's about 10 different grasses at the Garden Centre sell, which is a kind of tiny proportion of what could be used.
Right.
People are, and I think what's happening is that the keen gardeners are now feeling able to rip up their lawns, and whereas you know, more conventionally people are slow to change, certainly.
Well, and big box stores certainly don't help that either with their buying practices.
No.
And you know,
no,
I think that's where a lot of the mentality comes from.
Yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
One of the things that Carmen and I found really interesting about you is your broad range of writing. You've written books on green roofs and small spaces and indoor gardens and seed heads. What do you think ties all these together other than your love of plants?
I think innovation. I'm a great believer in innovation. I mean, the world keeps going on innovation. You know, we have to innovate to survive. I think it all comes down to really understanding plants, which in many ways have still got a long way to go. I mean, I've talked about using plants as like words in a design language.
Mm-hmm.
I can also think we should think about using plants as words in a more technical language that can do a lot for improving the atmosphere in urban spaces, in covering buildings, using plants as a kind of almost an engineering material, which can do so much to improve the environment of, particularly of urban areas. And to do that, we actually have to understand how they work in a very physical way, mm-hmm. you know, how quickly they spread, how long they live, how long they establish, that kind of thing, which conventional garden reference literature or landscape reference literature doesn't really help you with very much. I mean, I did a PhD research with the University of Sheffield looking at that. I got some funding for a research project last year from the European Union, which enabled me to set up a whole questionnaire for gardeners, domestic gardeners, looking at this, tapping into some of that enormous body of knowledge that hobby gardeners have. And the knowledge is out there, and we need to sort of gather all that together. But I think it's all about using plants as building elements for creating visual beauty or for doing hard, techie things.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, we have to take a break. Hang on the line with us. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Welcome back. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We have Noel Kingsbury on the line from England, and we are talking all about gardens. Noel, we noticed that you lecture fairly widely, and I noticed that one of the topics you've lectured on is the politics of the garden. So I was reading a little bit more about that, and one of the lines that struck me in your blog was why cultures are so different in their gardens. Like, how does that happen? Mm-hmm. So can you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the gardening does seem to be something very deep within certain cultures and not others.
Yeah.
And that gardens can get quite labelled. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at, say, the Mediterranean, you know, Italy, Spain, you know, this whole fantastic tradition of these very formal gardens. Mm-hmm. And I think they rather look at askance at our gardening style, which is much looser, much more relaxed. Or somewhere like India, which is an interesting example, because mm-hmm. there's no native Hindu tradition of gardening. The models for gardening in India are basically Islamic or British Imperial. Mm-hmm. Now, neither of those are a very attractive option for a culture which is sort of rather caught up in a kind of Hindu nationalism at the moment.
Right, right.
So it's difficult to see what those models for gardening are, whereas if you go to Pakistan, you can see amazing little gardens in the most extraordinary places, there's almost like this very deep approach to garden making that kind of everyone understands in Pakistan, mm-hmm. Quite formulaic, but really rather beautiful, that you simply don't see over the border in India.
Well, that's really interesting, because it's kind of an arbitrary border, isn't it?
Good point.
Border, yes, one of the many embarrassments of the British Empire.
I'm not trying to put you on the spot, Noel. I was just wondering.
Well, we are talking politics, so yeah. Next up, religion. Yeah. No, I'm just kidding.
So what do you think, I mean, just, you know...
It's a vernacular.
Why do you think in India they didn't develop this? You know, it's an ancient culture. It's a, you know, it's very varied and rich. Why do you think it doesn't have its own, you know, Indian?
I honestly don't know. I mean, it's a very intriguing question.
Yeah.
In a way, I would argue that perhaps the garden, the ornamental garden, has only been invented twice in history, once in pre-Islamic Persia, 2,000 years ago, mm-hmm. plus, and the other time in China, sort of about 1,500 years ago, and that all our models of gardening globally really go back to two of those really very ancient cultures.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. So the politics of the garden then, what do you think about Obama's White House garden on the front lawn?
His vegetable garden.
Well, it's good to see the Obamas getting in on the act of growing their own vegetables. I mean, the whole thing of growing your own vegetables, which is as big here as I think it is with you guys, and it seems to be a global thing. I think Gallup's very big in Japan as well. I mean, it's fantastic to see that, because it's getting an awful lot of more people, 30-somethings in particular, into gardening.
Right.
So it's really good to see.
This is a great segue, because I think Carmen and I were really excited to talk to you about your feelings on, your new book is called Hybrid, and your feelings on this whole organic movement. Tell us a little bit more. Of course, Carmen and I have read, but I want to hear you speak on it. So let's talk a little bit about
Hybrid was a book looking at the history of plant breeding, which ended up basically being a look at crops, wheat, barley, potatoes, maize, corn, carrots, right. and apples, mm-hmm. and all the rest of it. How you look at the wild ancestors mm-hmm. so often, and they look completely inedible, or they taste foul, or you think, how do we get from this insignificant wild plant to the sort of big juicy things we pick up in the farmer's market or the supermarket or wherever?
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered there wasn't a book on all of that, and it's a fantastic story full of really this wonderful rich cast of characters, farmers, entrepreneurs, scientists, and others who, over history, and particularly over the last 200 years, have done so much to transform crops and vegetables. And plant breeding really does feed the world.
Mm-hmm.
And we are going to be more and more dependent on it with rising populations and climate change and everything.
Yeah, to have a real deep understanding of it and to do it economically and environmentally sensibly, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
But I read something that you have a little bit of a skepticism for the organic movement, and I thought that was a really interesting statement from a gardener. What exactly did you mean by that, Noel?
Well, I think it's always useful to think about what you do on your plot at home and how that relates to the world as a whole. And I think that the trouble is there's a lot of people who've been gardening their own little plot very successfully organically,
mm-hmm.
and given the propaganda of the organic industry, they're made to think, well, actually, if I can do this, can we feed the world organically? And the answer is absolutely no. Something like a third of the world's population is actually indirectly dependent on synthetic nitrogen. There's those chemical nitrogen fertilizers that really keep us as a species going.
Fritz Haber.
And that in the global picture, organic agriculture simply does not add up, although it may be an attractive methodology for small-scale vegetable production.
Mm-hmm.
And I get very worried when I see very, this is kind of lazy assumption that organic is actually capable of producing the yields that conventional agriculture can, which it simply can't.
Right.
And I think the organic movement has also lost a huge trick in rejecting genetically modified crops, which are a way of really dramatically reducing the amount of pesticides you need in agriculture. I mean, there's tremendous potential here for really targeted, intelligent breeding. And it's interesting, in fact, there's a book published a year ago by a husband and wife team of Californian research scientists. She's a biotechnologist, he's an organic farmer, and they were arguing very much that the future of organic agriculture is actually biotechnology.
Mm-hmm.
So looking at new varieties that are having them a sort of natural resistance to insect and disease problems, and this is very much the way forward. And unfortunately, most of the organic movement has a kind of an anti-science, rather backward-looking, very romantic approach to farming issues, which I think is very, very deeply unconstructive, and I feel very disturbed by that.
Can you tell us a little bit about the genetics conference of 1902 and 1906? I was reading that a little bit in your blog.
Yes, that was when the world discovered genetics, largely through discovering what the Czech monk Gregor Mendel had been doing, researching in his monastery in the latter years of the 19th century. Genetics as a word arrived at around about that time, at 1900. It must have been an incredibly exciting time to live, because over about 3 or 4 years, there was an annual conference that brought together researchers and from Germany, France, Britain, and the United States. There was a couple organized in London, one in Paris, and one in New York. And this was when the whole science of genetics was actually being discovered, and it was very largely being discovered through gardening. And you had some rather extraordinary characters turning up at these conferences, these very Victorian amateur gentlemen gardeners who were often quite aristocratic. They often employed a lot of staff, and they were able to do all these breeding experiments with whatever they fancied. It might be something really practical like barley, or it might be something completely esoteric like some rare orchid. But they would perform these breeding experiments as basically making simple crosses and coming out either for or against Mendel. And these conferences just sounded very, very much more elaborate affairs than conferences now, and there were sort of bands and huge great big meals and a lot of kind of formal flim-flam that it makes a modern scientific conference sound a rather boring
snore
affair,
snore
like
right
snore snore yes.
Yeah, well, that would make a good HBO movie.
Yeah, but it has to be said that the record of the New York conference was that it was very much more sober than the British ones, which involved an awful lot of eating and drinking.
Well, I always find it interesting, you know, when we talk about amateur, right, and what that word really means, you know. Alice and I met at the Horticultural Society of New York, which was, you know,
Oh, yes.
It, I'm sure.
We both worked there.
We worked there.
I did give a lecture there a zillion years ago.
Yes.
Well, they, you know, they were the ladies and the gentlemen, again, you know, probably not quite aristocratic, but our version of aristocracy, you know, which is Wall Street.
Yes.
And, you know,
Morgan
the,
and
yeah, and the ladies and the wives of those gentlemen, and sometimes the gentlemen well, were plant lovers. And the thing that they didn't try to immediately patent what they found, you know, if they there was a lot more, I found during that era, a sharing of knowledge and information, which, you know, which doesn't happen now. You know, I don't think nearly as much as it should, you know, and that it is a romantic notion in a sense, because it just they were so in love with their irises. Let's say they would spend decades working on it. They were not, you know, they were not trained plants people. They were just they just loved it. They were true lovers of the art and wanted to share. And we owe so much, you know, to them, to these amateur gardeners, you know.
But go ahead and tell that to the suburban, you know, person in the middle of whatever state you want to pick on a map, you know. There's no connection to horticulture anymore as a culture. And that, you know, that goes back to the politics of the garden and the design that you do, and you're trying to, you know, bring natives to the forefront and use them in a daily application, you know. It's just a sad story, but yet it's such a buzzword at the same time, this whole organic movement and, you know, anti-science, and yet, you know, thank God for science, because we're all still alive and we have penicillin. You know?
I know, but we're living
science feeds us and keeps us alive, and there's an awful lot of us now to keep alive on a small planet.
And we have to feed people, like you're saying, you know. So I'm excited to actually read your book Hybrid, which is just out now, right? When did
it? It's out now, yes.
Okay,
yes,
good.
No, it's had some good reviews, and the reviews do stress it's like reading a good novel, so that's...
That helps. Is it by Timber Press, Noel?
Was it it's University of Chicago.
Oh, University of Chicago.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'd like to sort of end the show and ask you, this is probably a question that you get asked a lot, but I think our listeners would like to know, we have listeners from all over the world, can you tell us five gardens that you think, you know, folks should visit that best exemplify the best in garden design and plantsmanship today, anywhere in the world, not limited to the U.S. necessarily, but places that can really inspire people and you know, with design and with good horticulture?
Sure. Well, I've got two in the U.S. One is the High Line, of which we were speaking in Manhattan, which is... You know, I think it's the wildest thing that Pete Aldolf has done. I mean, there's fantastic plants that give you a really good long season in a very difficult space and a difficult environment.
Mm-hmm.
Chanticleer in Pennsylvania,
yeah.
Really fantastic, very creative garden, terrific range of plants. Then over this side of the pond, in England, Great Dixter. Not necessarily my style of planting. It's very sort of high energy, but it's the result of really careful plant selection, really high knowledge of what plants are capable of doing.
Yes, that was Christopher Lloyd's garden, right?
Artistic vision.
Yes, it was.
That was the late Christopher Lloyd, and
right.
Very much carried on with Fergus Garrett.
Mm-hmm.
Then in France, a garden called Le Jardin de Béchigrange, which is right up in the Vosges Mountains. It's a garden that it could be, I can imagine it somewhere up in Vermont or in the hills outside Portland, Oregon. Or it is actually quite a North American feeling place with these hills covered in conifers. And an incredibly inventive, very wild garden where they seem to have just got this balance between design and wildness. And then in Germany, a garden called Hermannshof, mm-hmm. in a town called Weinheim in the Rhine Valley, which is very experimental. It's right in the middle of town. It's effectively a public park. A very wide range of plants in these sort of habitat groupings. So it's great on plantsmanship, and it's all about looking at the plant community, the plant combination. So it's a very, very exciting place to see plant combinations that you can imagine being used elsewhere on a either a smaller scale or indeed a bigger scale.
Well, and also your work. I mean, I had a blast looking at your website and just, you know, drooling over those pictures and those hillsides that you've designed. Mm. I mean, they are absolutely sublime. So
yes, and I always get very envious, Noel, when someone has an address with the word cottage in it and no numeral.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That just doesn't happen in New York,
no.
You know.
No.
It was a cottage and no numeral.
Yeah.
So the mail gets to him.
Well, you know, we do enjoy coming over and getting the city buzz. So
yes.
It works both ways.
Yeah.
Good, good. Well, if you're ever in New York, we want you to come and visit us.
Well, I will do. I usually seem to come over about once a year. I mean, it's great to see in New York the amount of community gardening that's taking off. And,
yes.
It has become horticulturally now really quite an exciting city.
Yeah, yeah.
Lyndon Miller is a friend of ours, and she's done a lot, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No, she's a hero. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a lot going on, too, with gardens on big farms on rooftops here. The Grange is affiliated with this radio station. And so that's been really fun to watch the produce come off of the top of the buildings. So.
Yeah. No, that's very exciting.
Yeah.
And good use of the space.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
And we look forward to hopefully connecting with you soon here in the United States.
Yeah. Great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Noel.
Thank Noel.
Good.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Well, you've been listening to the Heritage Radio Network and We Dig Plants. We'd like to thank Roberta's Pizza at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and our sponsors. We'd like to thank our producer and engineer, Jack Inslee. Please join us on our Facebook fan page, Groundworks, Inc., We Dig Plants. We'd love your feedback, and we're going to be posting a link to Noel's blog and his website. So thanks for listening. See you in the garden.